And welcome to the December 16th edition of Gray Matters. Tonight on the show, we have a lecture presented by Stephen Brzuszka, former emergency room physician in Seattle. It's entitled Social Murder and COVID-19. Stephen Brzuszka is on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington, and he worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He's worked in Nepal for more than a decade, where he helped set up a community health project a week's walk from the road. He also established a remote district hospital for training Nepali doctors whom he supervised. So, this lecture was recorded in November of 2021 in Seattle, Washington. Here it is, Social Murder and COVID-19 by Stephen Brzuszka.
Today, we have many COVID deniers, anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, others who don't want their freedoms to be impinged. The future for Americans looks increasingly precarious. This country is one of the most stressed in the world. Chronic stress is the 21st century tobacco. Big business produces the stress. Stressing out a population is social murder.
That's Stephen Brzuszka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Dr. Stephen Brzuszka on social murder and COVID-19. The concept of social murder was introduced in the mid-19th century. The German philosopher Friedrich Engels coined the phrase in describing the political and social power held by ruling elites over laborers in England. Engels wrote about poor workers dying prematurely. Today, during the current pandemic, the term has been revived. The British Medical Journal says, "Social murder may describe the lack of political attention to social detriments and inequities that exacerbate the pandemic. Enormous discrepancies in income and wealth have huge health consequences. Failure to address them has no doubt contributed to the global death toll from the pandemic, which now exceeds 5 million. The actual number must be much higher. The economic and class realities exposed and magnified by COVID-19 cannot be ignored or spun away. The need for a system that is equitable has never been more apparent." To talk about these issues is Dr. Stephen Brzuszka. He's on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. He spoke in Seattle in early November. And now, Dr. Stephen Brzuszka.
The world is facing a fork in the road. One direction leads to more alienation, doom-scrolling, and despair, and possibly even total destruction. The second involves recognizing that we humans have a responsibility for the planet that requires honoring the nest it has made for us and making sure that other creatures survive along with us. We need the wisdom and the will to make the right choice. We've been fighting World War III, undeclared by Congress or any other body, for over a year and a half. How are we doing? Well, with the most cases and deaths from COVID-19, the United States is clearly losing the war. Considering the world, the tally on November 1st, 2021 is almost 5 million deaths. The United States is pushing 750,000 of those, or about 15% of the total. This for a country with only 4% of the global population. There have been a variety of battle strategies for today's war, many of which conflict with one another. China, where the current war started, has had less than 5,000 deaths. Remarkable for a population that is almost five times larger than ours. Their battle strategy we would consider repressive, namely the violation of individual rights and lockdown when necessary. Today, they do large-scale testing, regulate travel, and use other social control measures. Russia has had over 250,000 of deaths, and India close to 500,000. Brazil is up there with over 600,000. All published estimates are likely undercounts. We shouldn't expect our outcomes from the pandemic to be anything to brag about, since before COVID-19, some 35 countries had lower death rates than Americans. This includes all the other rich countries and some poorer ones, including Peru, Slovenia, Sri Lanka, and Tunisia. Before SARS-CoV-2 struck, our life expectancy had been declining, adult mortality was rising, and other signs that showed that we Americans were dead first. For almost a decade, we were dying younger than people in many other nations. Although occasionally reported in the media, most Americans remained unaware of this tragedy. Why do people here refuse to consider these killer facts? There are several reasons for this denial. One is indifference. As long as we're alive, why should we care about others who are not or who are dying? Eli Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, said, "The opposite of love is not hatred, but indifference. Indifference. We just don't care." How to counter indifference? Well, as a species, humans are altruistic. That is, we look out for each other. While our genes may be selfish, our species is not, unless we've been bombarded by propaganda saying we're individuals and need to pursue our own rights. We are told we live in a meritocracy, which rewards individual hard work. Not true. To not be indifferent, we need skills to think critically. We need to reason scientifically and come to one's own conclusion. Preemption, namely pushing legislation to counter certain tendencies in America, has the Texas Republican Party standing against the teaching of critical thinking. They say it would conflict with parental authority and focus on behavior modification. To teach critical thinking, teachers should present several perspectives in class and have students practice reasoning and evaluating sources. How critically do Americans think? About 25% of Americans believe the sun goes around the earth. We have the smallest proportion of the population among rich countries believing in evolution. And a substantial proportion of millennials, 1/3 according to Forbes magazine, believe the earth is flat. Distraction from vital issues is another factor in why we don't try to change our high death rates. As E.O. Wilson, the Harvard entomologist, said, "We're drowning in information, but lacking in wisdom." Whether it is false news on Facebook, or clickbait on another internet site, or a flick recommended for you on Netflix, we can be convinced, or deluded, or drawn into whiling away precious hours to not see the forest or the trees. Today, we have many COVID deniers, anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, others who don't want their freedoms to be impinged. The future for Americans looks increasingly precarious. We were caught unprepared for the current pandemic for several reasons, including a massive defunding of public health efforts. Health departments at the city, county, state, or federal level have had to do more with less and less. There's increasing staff turnover for this stressful work. Public health officers tend to be disdained by the public. Some face death threats. When you see your own doctor for treatment of an illness or injury, you're grateful for the help provided. But when your county or state health officer tries to keep you alive, you hate it. So many Americans see public health workers as the enemy and not SARS-CoV-2. Morale in public health agencies has seriously dwindled. Many have abandoned those careers while fighting our World War III. It doesn't bode well for the next pandemic, which is sure to strike before long. Preemptive laws in 32 states have recently been upgraded by legislators to limit emergency powers of state and local health departments. These affect vaccine and mask orders and limiting restrictions on businesses, schools, or churches. County health departments are being fined millions of dollars for mandating employee vaccinations. Laws limit quarantining infected people and COVID-19 contact tracing. Individual rights replace collective responsibilities. Proven public health prevention measures are neglected. When did the divergence begin? Over 185 years ago, Friedrich Engels, describing the living and working conditions British workers experienced with capitalism that led them to an early death. He termed this murder similar to, quote, the deed of the single individual, disguised malicious murder, murder against which none can defend himself, which does not seem to be what it is because no man sees the murderer, because the death of the victim seems a natural one, since the offense is more one of omission than of commission. But murder it remains, end of quote. This is social murder. There is no smoking gun. Our COVID casualties represent social murder. The laws we're describing, those already passed, condone social murder. We need to focus public attention on this lethal crime. Every state has proposed similar legislation, although legal battles or vetoes by governors will surely limit the carnage. I worked as an emergency physician for 30 years. There's an effective process in ERs for dealing with some conditions. Let me elaborate. When you go to the emergency department, you will get your vital signs checked soon after entry: temperature, pulse, blood pressure, and breathing rate. These are called vital signs because if they're far out of the normal range, something needs to be done soon or death ensues. I had the rule of fours to guide me. You could live for 4 minutes without air, 4 days without water, and 4 weeks without food. Not breathing was the most urgent issue I had to address. If your pulse and blood pressure were normal, and you were talking, I could wait and finish seeing the patient I was attending to. If you're a very young child with a high fever, I had to cool that youngster right away. There are normal ranges for what an individual's vital signs are. If your pulse and blood pressure was zero, then you were dead, and my job was done, and all I had to do was fill out a death certificate containing your name, age, the date, and probable cause of death. I now consider the country as the patient in the current health crisis. What vital signs should we measure, and what are ranges of normals for those? After I filled out the death certificate in the ER, it would be sent to the state and later linked with that person's birth certificate to compile that person's age at death. With these numbers, one can calculate various mortality rates. How many died in their first year of life? Infant mortality. In the first 5 years? Child mortality. Then adolescent mortality, Adult mortality is typically the probability of dying between ages 15 and 60. With all these numbers, it's straightforward to calculate average length of life for people alive that year if the mortality rates didn't change from year to year. That is life expectancy. The ideal would be that the vital signs of all countries should be the same, all good. There's no biological reason why the vital signs of any country shouldn't be that of the country with the best outcomes, the best or healthiest. Just like if you had all the money in the world, you would usually choose to buy the best product, car or house or vacation home or whatever. Typically, the best is often the most expensive, but not always. So which country has the lowest mortality rates? Brace yourself, it's not America. We could boast of being one of the healthiest countries in the world during the early 1950s, but not today. There are some 50 countries where people live longer, healthier lives than we do. These include all the other rich nations and some poorer ones, such as Chile, Slovenia, and Costa Rica. The country with the longest life expectancy is Japan. The Japanese have a life expectancy 7 years longer than Americans. Do those 7 years just represent more time drooling in a nursing home? Well, our leading causes of death are heart disease and cancer, which will kill close to half of all the people dying in any 1 year here. Throw in COVID deaths for 2020, and those three represent more than half of all deaths. Suppose we eradicated those three causes. We would gain about 7 years in life expectancy. Consider what that means. Today, to become the longest-lived country, we would have to eradicate, cure, or eliminate our three leading disease killers. That's a huge health difference between America and the healthiest nation. We're decidedly abnormal when it comes to our health. Yes, most Americans are not aware, nor do they seem to care of this mortal fact. I get my students to calculate how many children die every day in America that shouldn't if only they lived in Slovenia. About 50 children die every day in the United States that needn't, since Slovenia shows what is possible. We spend more money on healthcare in this country than almost all of the other nations combined. Sick people outside America who have financial means come here for what they see as the best medical treatment in the world. Japan's medical care system doesn't explain their good health. Two major factors affect the health of populations. One is how much economic inequality they tolerate, and the other is how much they support early life. Inequality kills, and early life lasts a lifetime. I will explore these two key issues in some detail, as they're critically important for not only understanding why we don't have such good health here, but also in knowing what needs to be done to have healthier lives. The first studies demonstrating income inequality leading to worse health began in 1979. Now, hundreds of studies demonstrate how income and wealth inequality damage a population's health. In the United States, we have the most extreme inequality imaginable. Consider wealth inequality, which is considerably higher than that of income. America's billionaires have become $2.1 trillion richer during the pandemic, from just $3 trillion at the start of the crisis in March 2020 to over $5 trillion in mid-October 2021. I'm talking trillions, not just billions. These 745 Americans have two-thirds more wealth than the bottom half of U.S. households. Their increase in wealth is obscene pandemic profiteering. Yet, just like our being dead first, there's hardly any outcry. We're indifferent to such damning numbers. Why would inequality be killing us? Living in a very unequal society produces a great deal of stress. We compare ourselves to those who have more than us and feel ashamed that we haven't worked hard enough to prosper as much as they do. They achieved the American dream, and I didn't. This leads to deaths of despair. We find this among middle-aged whites who've been doing much dirty work in our country and not being financially rewarded. Rather than blaming the way our country is set up to reward those who have too much, they feel guilty for not having succeeded. Social murder results. Their lives are shortened by the usual causes of death, as well as by drinking too much, using too many harmful drugs, and by suicide. This country is one of the most stressed in the world. Chronic stress is the 21st century tobacco. Big business produces the stress. Stressing out a population is social murder. With high inequality, the rich use their wealth to set up a system so they pay negligible tax and do not have to support providing services to those who have less than they do. When you combine local, county, state, and federal taxes, the richest 400 Americans pay a lower proportion of their income in taxes than any other group here. That wasn't the case in the 1950s, when a substantial chunk of their income was collected in taxes. Today, they prefer to not be taxed and have poorer folk bear the tax burden, whether federal, state, or local. Most of us remain indifferent to this plight. Not being taxed is a critical value in this country. Nobody here wants to pay taxes, although taxation is the price we pay to live in a functioning democracy. In Sweden, where there are high taxes, the people don't object to being so heavily taxed, as they get many free services in return. Not just universal health care, but very generous paid parental leave, among many others. If you have a baby in Sweden, you get your full salary for 444 days. The leave is mandatory. For the rest of your toddler's second year, it is optional at a lower rate of pay. In your child's third year in Sweden, he or she can receive free daycare. The requirement to be a daycare worker in Sweden is to have an advanced degree in play. That's what daycare is about. The child needs to play and socialize with others. Contrast that with our lack of any federal paid leave policy. We are one of only two countries without a nationally mandated paid maternal leave policy. The other nation is Papua New Guinea. We get what we pay for, namely dying younger than we should. Social murder. Let's consider next the importance of supporting early life. Roughly half of our health as adults is programmed in the first 1,000 days after conception. Consider the first 9 months in the womb. You develop from a single cell, called a zygote, when your father's sperm fertilized your mother's ovum, which she made in your maternal grandmother's womb. That single cell divides about 42 times to produce a newborn. Cell division is a very sensitive period that can be impacted by many factors, including stress, many drugs, radiation, and toxic chemicals. Your birth weight, how much you weighed when you came out of your mother, shows how well you developed inside her. The more of those dangerous elements that are that are present, the lower your birth weight. We in the United States have among the lowest average birth weights of all rich nations. This partly explains our high infant and child mortality, as well as our not living so long. Also, poorer mothers have more low birth weight babies. Some groups, besides those of lesser economic means in this country, are further disadvantaged. African Americans have almost twice the rate of low birth weight, that is less than 5.5 pounds, of whites because of racism. Racism combined with inequality produces a double whammy, two strikes. Children born of low birth weight are more susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 infection. They're also more likely to suffer a severe case of COVID-19. The first 2 years of life matter as much as all that follow in producing better adult health. During that time, you need supportive parenting to develop secure attachment. John Bowlby studied orphans after World War II to discover they needed a consistent single-parent figure in their first year to develop secure attachment and healthier lives. Such children could explore their environments knowing they could return to a protected, loving place. If there were too many caregivers or unsupportive ones or none, dysfunctional attachments, such as avoidant or insecure attachment, would develop that were not good for health, as we no longer had a secure base to return to. There's no one right or best way to parent. In Africa, it takes a village to raise a child. Here, it takes a family. And typically, there's just one parent present, which makes desirable outcomes less likely. Early life lasts a lifetime. If your early life has been compromised, there's no magic pill or surgical procedure that can undo the harm done then. Senator Elizabeth Warren, when she was a Harvard law professor, studied a typical two-parent, two-child family. She compared one in 1970 with one in 2000, adding up all the income and costs they incurred. She found that with only one parent working outside the home in 1970, the family had more money left over after paying for necessary expenses than the 2000 family with both parents working. What changed is how this country set up policies required to get more people into the labor force working at lower wages. These changes increased profits for those at the top of the capitalist pyramid. Many of you use the terms health and healthcare synonymously. You talk of accessing health, paying for health, getting health, ensuring health, when you're not doing any of those actions. It's all about healthcare. You pay for healthcare, get healthcare, ensure healthcare, and so on. Until we recognize how little healthcare matters for producing health, we won't be able to take the steps that really matter. So contrast spending on health care with spending on social factors. Examples of social spending includes paid family or parental leave, free daycare and preschool, free education, generous unemployment benefits, sickness, cash benefits, housing support, and of course the right to access health care. Healthier rich countries spend more on social benefits than on health care. The reverse is true in the United States. We don't put our money where it matters. Government social spending is much better at improving health than private spending by philanthropies and charities. One study estimates that if we had the level of public social spending found in other rich nations, we would have more than 3 years longer life expectancy. The type of social spending matters immensely. Take child care. The Scandinavian governments spend 60 times more per person on childcare than we do. The Swedish government spends more in the first year of life than for any subsequent year. In this country, federal spending targets remedial actions in later years because we fail to support early life. Not only do our children suffer, but also the adults they become. Why do Americans appear to be comfortable living in a society where governments are not supposed to help their citizens much and spend more on childcare, for example? I've long been puzzled over possible reasons. America has the lowest rates of taxation on income and wealth of all rich nations. Although today there is some desire to change that, it's unclear how successful that will be. Harvard political economist Benjamin Friedman suggests some religious reasons for accepting government neglect. We turned away from fatalism to believe we must depend on our own ability and efforts. Next, our voluntary activities will take care of the needy. Another has evangelicals waiting for the rapture or third coming that will produce peaceful, blissful existence. There's a common belief, at least in the Southeast and Appalachia, that people receiving welfare benefits don't deserve them, as they haven't worked hard enough. My thinking is evolving. I don't have all the answers for why Americans put up with not taxing the rich and letting the poor struggle by themselves, but I won't stop asking good questions.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on social murder and COVID-19. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and Noam Chomsky's latest book, Consequences of Capitalism, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977.
The ideas I presented lead to a prescription for good health along the following lines. Don't have poor parents. Don't be poor. If you're poor, try not to be poor for long. Don't live in a country where there are a few very rich people, nor where there are many poor people. Don't work in a stressful, low-paid, meaningless job. Be born in a caring and sharing society. Based on evidence and common sense, this is the best health advice I can give. Better than don't smoke and all those usual admonitions. What I've been saying is not new. John Donne, the metaphysical British poet who wrote No Man Is an Island in the 17th century, the poem ends with, quote, "Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." End of quote. The suffering of other people tolls for you and me. Others are not just those you know, but also those you never thought about. The unfortunate victims of life we can't imagine for ourselves affect our health. This is not an intuitive idea for individualist Americans to consider, but it helps explain our being dead first. That is why economic inequality matters and how society structures early life affects my health. Social murder at work. Armed with this information, let's return to World War III. For most of its history, since America's founding in 1776, this country's been at war. There are fewer than 20 years during this 250-year period when we have not been at war. This war is different, however, because the enemy is an unseen critter, a coronavirus that has invaded our bodies. And we're not sure how to fight this foe. Whatever battle strategies we've been using have not been successful, as we have the most battle casualties of any countries. What tactics have we been using? When the battle started, say March 2020, public health experts advise us to avoid other people, especially indoors. Wear an effective mask and decontaminate surfaces others may have left contagion on. We learned that aerosols spread by breathing, coughing, and sneezing were the primary weapons the enemy used to invade us. If somebody had been successfully attacked and invaded, that is, they became infected, they were advised to isolate themselves, to quarantine. Quarantines, strict isolation of an injured combatant, have been used for centuries to control plagues, influenzas, tuberculosis, and now SARS-CoV-2 transmission. The battle strategies of testing, contact tracing, that is, checking out other people whom the infected person has been near, and quarantining were successfully used in East Asia, especially South Korea, China, Taiwan, and Japan in the initial stages of battle. Australia and New Zealand used these strategies successfully. People in those countries trusted their governments and complied with public health advice. Public health prevention works in three ways. Primary prevents infection by quarantining infected people to prevent them transmitting to others, or immunize someone to prevent getting an infection. Consider the success of smallpox and polio vaccines. Pharmaceutical companies do not want to spend money to develop drugs to prevent a disease. Their profits will be limited. The current crop of vaccines to prevent COVID-19 came from massive government funding to research and develop the products. Once the vaccines were deemed effective to prevent disease, they were given to Big Pharma to make huge profits by producing and selling them. Big Pharma doesn't want their vaccines to be produced by drug companies in poor countries. They circumvent this by demanding their intellectual property rights. Secondary prevention screens for early detection and cure of a disease. Once again, there's not much incentive for Big Pharma to cure something, as there are very few ways to recoup costs by profiting off continued use of the drug, because once cured, you don't need the drug. Tertiary prevention tries to limit the effects of chronic diseases, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, and many others, by having those people stay on expensive maintenance drugs for the rest of their lives. That's where big profits lie. People aren't cured. You're bombarded by messages to ask your doctor about. Almost none of these ads are for preventive or curative drugs. Mostly the ads address recently discovered, patented, highly profitable drugs. Governments fund basic research and development of a product and then hand the selling of it at no cost over to private industry to garner huge profits. Examples include developing military aircraft at public expense and then letting private industry, such as Boeing, make huge profits. Produce the basic computer and do further government research to make a small machine profitable. Then hand it over to IBM and Apple to make money hands over fist. Who pays for the government research? Of course you do. Who makes the profits or gets royalties from the sales? Not you. Was developing immunizations the best strategy for the pandemic? At this point, it is unclear, since we've seen SARS-CoV-2 develop many quite lethal variants, such as the current Delta one, whose spread may have been enhanced by the vaccines. I bring this up because some experts say it will lead to a never-ending war rather than victory. That is because the enemy, the virus, will outsmart us and become an eternal part of our lives, like the seasonal flu, which typically kills some 30 to 50,000 a year in the U.S. and more than 10 times that globally. Big Pharma loves forever wars. So I question the vaccine as a long-term strategy, but I'm someone who received the vaccine in early 2021 and then came across people arguing that this may not be the best plan. Thinking critically, I can see that in the short term, vaccines make sense, but they may not be in the long term. Such reasoning is not unusual in U.S. history. In 1945, in the previous World War, America received news that Japan would surrender on one condition, that we not execute their emperor. Knowing that, we dropped two atomic bombs, mass murder, on Japan, because we wanted to send a strong message to Russia about our newfound powerful force. That spawned the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. Is the same scenario being played out now? America developed a vaccine and did not want to share it with other nations, or at least only with a few selected ones. This has led to a vaccine development arms race. There will be close to 100 other vaccines for COVID in use throughout the world soon. How effective will they be? Will they help us be prepared for the next contagion? I've already said we've taken our most effective military, our public health system in this country, and demobilized it so few troops remain. And state and local officials have had a field day demonizing the remaining army. Not a good sign for future human health. We are facing a moral dilemma. Remember the two forks in the road I began with. One leads to alienation and despair and perhaps total destruction. We may be seeding that outcome with our lack of global cooperation in fighting the pandemic, as well as with global warming and the nuclear threat. Not a good harbinger to consider. What about the other fork? Honoring the nest we've made for ourselves and ensuring other creatures survive along with us. Let's explore that choice. Many people recognize the global warming threat and what it will do in the future. Progressives speak of a Green New Deal. Recall that President Roosevelt enacted New Deal legislation to save capitalism in the 1930s and 40s. Using renewables energy is today's Green New Deal, something for our late-stage capitalist economies. Technology solutions such as windmills, solar panels, biofuels are being presented as methods to allow us to maintain our standard of living. Critics have argued that these are bright green lies rather than Green New Deals. There's a strong argument that we cannot sustain our current level of consumption with our current human population numbers. The technological solutions require further exploitation of non-renewable resources, from mining minerals and thinking we can successfully recycle the resulting products that have only a short lifespan. Raising such a heretical criticism with people is not well received. We want to believe technology will save us. In the near future, it will just transform the situation to a more difficult problem we will have to deal with later. Our current SARS-CoV-2 pandemic has resulted from massive habitat destruction that allows pathogens from other animals to make the jump onto humans. COVID-19 has shown that we need to analyze the system we've created and take a long-term view of what matters and how to achieve that. But our children and grandchildren will need to face this question if they wish to have a sustainable future. What is happening around the world in this pandemic? It is very hard to make sense of the various patterns we see. Some countries, such as Israel, that have had very high rates of vaccinations, have had surges. The southeast of part of the United States, where immunizations were low, had a surge that has since waned. Alaska has the most cases and deaths these days, about 10 times that of Louisiana that was surging months before. Who will be next? India, where there seemed to be a serious problem half a year ago, has turned the corner for whatever reason. African countries appear to have been spared the worst devastation. Eastern Europe is not doing well. Poor countries, especially those with huge external debts, face serious problems going forward. Creditors such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are unlikely to forget those debts, which can amount to more than a quarter of a country's economy. There are also debt repayments to private banks. There is currently huge unemployment, especially in the informal sector, in low-income countries. Extreme poverty is growing. We can expect civil wars there in the future. Many countries used to rely on expatriate workers going to oil-rich nations and sending them money back to support families. Not today. Businesses in rich nations are decreasing their investments in low-income nations as demands for their products has diminished. China is producing for its own markets rather than for us. We have serious supply chain problems resulting. We have a global production and delivery mess. COVID-19 has caused a great reset, and it is unclear how we're going to reboot. Business as usual is not an option. The United States has some very serious problems dealing with World War III. We have a record number of overdose deaths, topping 93,000 in 2020. To put this in perspective, number of car crash deaths peaked in 1972 at 50,000. Gun deaths in 2017 at over 35,000. Why such high overdose deaths? Studies show we suffer from more pain than people in other countries. Pain comes in two varieties, physical pain and social pain. Pain medicine, even simple over-the-counter types such as acetaminophen or Tylenol, helps relieve social pain, of which we have so much. And then there are the opioids, which do a better job with social pain. So we medicate ourselves to death. Another form of social murder. Homicides, especially in urban areas, are rising. Increasing income inequality produces more homicides. So pandemic profiteering may account for many of these. Where are we in our current pandemic when we look into the mud-encrusted crystal ball? Earlier I talked about the world being in an economic system of late-stage capitalism. What I mean by that is that markets are being regulated in bizarre ways. We bail out the rich when there are slight difficulties and impose austerity or belt tightening for the rest of us. Corporate power is phenomenal, and federal policies ensure that it will remain so, pursuing profits at least for the near future. Is this ethical? Once, while crossing a 17,500-foot-high pass in Nepal that led from one major valley to another, I came across a frozen Nepali porter just below the pass. A previous group crossing the pass had hired lowlander Nepalis to carry supplies. When a storm came up, the leaders hoped others would help those having trouble, which didn't happen for this unfortunate young victim. Afterwards, I read an article in the Harvard Business Review by a managing director of Morgan Stanley, the giant Wall Street investment firm, who was as well an ordained elder of the United Presbyterian Church, who was crossing the same pass. He came across a scantily clad pilgrim trying to cross the pass. The author was worried about the effects of high altitude on his body and getting safely over the pass that day. He passed by the pilgrim and hoped others would help him. He reflected on the moral dilemma of how corporations follow the goals of their executives and shareholders and have no interest in the plight of others who might be affected by those goals. If he and his companion had helped the pilgrim to get down, he might not have crossed the pass, thereby not achieving his goals for that day. These experiences parallel with the COVID-19 situation, where we look after our own interests and not those of others. And governments have mostly disowned responsibility for all but the richest people. Social murder at work. We are fighting World War III, a battle which we aren't prepared for as we demobilized our public health troops some time ago. It will be very difficult to learn our lesson before the next pandemic strikes. What are you going to do with your one wild and precious life now? There's no going back to the old normal. As we saw, our health was not normal in this country before. It is even more abnormal now. We're in the midst of a profound revolution in way of life on the earth. What will be the next normal? Albert Einstein said, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." End of quote. Today, we need critical thinking, which is in short supply, given that we can buy our own reality on the internet. What is the new thinking we need? In old movies about the wild American West, we often saw posters on walls saying, "Wanted, dead or alive," with a sketch or picture of someone and a description of their crime. What would the wanted poster today look like? Consider, wanted, social murderer, preferably dead. And the picture might have any of various corporate logos which you're all familiar with. Engels was decrying capitalism as the murderer a century and a half ago. Today, the culprit is corporate hegemony. Their crime is to dominate small businesses, governments, and the rest of us by their almost universal power to control our lives. The biggest challenge the world has faced requires putting the social murderer in jail for life. How are we going to do this? We must draw attention to our dismantling of public health, especially in the United States. We must decrease murder by the capitalist system as the predominant cause of death. Nothing will change until we become aware of this issue. Then we have to have a plan or solution at hand. Major shifts in American policy depend on taking advantage of a transforming political event as Naomi Klein argued in Shock Doctrine, or John Kingdon in Agenda, Alternative, and Public Policies. Use your skills to inform others and to present effective plans. We have to rein in inequality and use the proceeds to support early life. We must resurrect the public health system to the level it was a few decades ago before becoming emaciated. Take guidance from those who've made profound changes in their societies. Nelson Mandela, the first president of South Africa after apartheid, said, quote, "Vision without action is just a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. And vision with action can change the world." Thank you for listening.
You were just listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on social murder and COVID-19. He spoke in Seattle in early November. Dr. Stephen Bezruchka is on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Kianga Yamata-Taylor, Tariq Ali, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. We also have a series of programs with Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on Social Murder and COVID-19, as well as for Noam Chomsky's latest book, Consequences of Capitalism, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. Stay tuned for Drama Text and an hour of spoken word recordings. Coming right up after some station business. Till next week.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly, fa la 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 la. Wash hands, use hand sanitizer, fa la 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 la.
You know the tune. If you're celebrating with your loved ones this holiday season, make sure to keep following the sanitary measures. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
Kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM. FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh.
Good evening and welcome to the December 16th edition of Drama Text. Tonight on the show we have another presentation from the Hammer Museum Poetry Series down in Los Angeles. This one is the poems of Robin Robinson. And lasts about an hour. And so we'll get to it right now. Here he is.
I'm Stephen Yenzer in the English department at UCLA. They're one of the sponsors, of course, of the readings, as is the Friends of English, and obviously the Hammer Museum and Cultural and Recreational Affairs at UCLA. Please turn off any noise-making gizmos that you have. And if you are not on my mailing list, that is to say the English department's mailing list, if you will see me after the reading, I will get you there. Then you'll be on yet another mailing list, and you'll never, never miss a poetry reading. So I was thinking yesterday about Robin Robertson's visit, and I was reading again in Sailing the Forest his new selected poems, and Hill of Doors, his most recent full volume, and Bacchae, his just-published translation of Euripides' play. Mr. Robertson is prolific.